Hi, this is Rodney Greenblatt from Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM.
The views expressed by on-air volunteer hosts do not reflect the views of Wavefarm or WGXC. WGXC is nonpartisan and does not endorse or support political candidates. To participate in WGXC's on-air dialogue, dial 518-622-2598 to either call in live to the studio or record a 3-minute message for broadcast expressing your point of view, or send an email to info@wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Time and Space Limited, TSL, in Hudson, New York, expanding minds since 1973. TSL is an art house for documentary, independent, and classic movies, a gallery.
.org.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Time and Space Limited, TSL, in Hudson, New York. Expanding minds.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. I'd just like to agree with that public service announcement. I, your host, Norman Douglas, the show, Good Night Norman, do not endorse any political candidates. Period. Now that we got that out of the way, tonight, fiction. I'm going to start off with the speculative kind. I guess all fiction is speculative. And that's all the editorializing I'm going to speculate on. The gods willing. Speaking of gods, this tale is entitled Prometheus Unbound. At last. By a writer, California-based writer named Kim Stanley Robinson. For those who are curious, Kim is not a female. I don't know anything about their sexual preferences or proclivities, but in contributors' notes I've seen, he's referred to as he. I've seen a picture, and he looks like a he. So Kim, I guess, is just one of those old school, what is it? It's Scandinavian name, right? even though the rest of his name is Anglo. Prometheus Unbound at Last, from a collection of short stories that he himself compiled of his work. Prometheus Unbound at Last by Kim Stanley Robinson. Please append your report here. This novel postulates that science is an ongoing utopian proto-political experiment, poorly theorized as such, and lacking a paradigm within which to exert power in human affairs commensurate with its actual productive capacity and life maintenance criticality. Scientists are first seen marginalized from macro decision-making in a backstory written in the style of a Cold War thriller, in which agents sequester science by convincing Truman et al. That science is metastasizing wartime ability to create new technologies crucial to victory, radar, penicillin, atom bomb, etc., might constitute a threat to post-war civilian corporate control of society. Scientists, subsequently inoperative in surplus value investment and allocation decisions, produce goods and services unconscious of themselves as a group and individually willing to work within the existing hierarchical, extractive, non-sustainable system for 100,000 plus or minus 50,000 annually, plus pension, stock options, and a light teaching load. This chapter is in the form of a zombie novel, highly amusing. Then the scientifically augmented human population catastrophically overshoots the long-term carrying capacity of the planet. Scientists and their various toothless non-decision-making organizations conclude that the anthropogenically initiated climate change and mass extinction event associated with it probably threatens their descendants' welfare and thus scientists' own evolutionary fitness. The sleepers awake. Meanwhile, a certain proportion of humanity makes a cost-benefit analysis comparing 15 years' work learning a science with saying, "I believe," and through group political action controlling more calories per capita than scientists do, also more power over funding and rather more offspring. Many conclude faith-based parasitism on science less costly to the individual, so more adaptive. Vampires living off zombies, guns brandished, chases by night. The novel gets pretty lurid at this point. Then, at a modeling conference, a discussion springs up concerning Hamilton's rule, which states that altruism should evolve whenever the cost to the giver, C, is less than the fitness benefits, B, obtained by helping another individual who's related by R, with R being calculated as the proportion of genes these two individuals share by common descent. As in Herdy, 1999, C being less than or equal to BR. A geneticist at the conference points out that as humans share 60% of their genes with fruit flies, and all eukaryotes share 938 core genes, R is probably always higher than heretofore calculated. An ecologist mentions the famous Nature article in which the benefits provided by the biosphere to humans were estimated at $33 trillion a year. This is in our Costanza et al., Nature 387, pages 253 to 260, 1997. An economist suggests that the cost for individual scientists wanting to maintain these benefits could be conceptualized in the form of a mutual hedge fund with initial investment set for the sake of discussion at $1,000 per scientist. Comic scene here as modelers debate the numbers with a biologist pointing out that the benefit of life to every living organism could justifiably be defined as infinity, considerably altering equation's results. Shouting, fights, saloon demolished in Wild West manner. Conference attendees conclude altruism is probably warranted, and hedge fund is established. Readers of novel wishing to pre-invest are directed to a website, www.sciencemutual.net. Participating scientists then vote to establish a board, a model constitution for all governments to adopt, a policy research institute tasked with forming a political platform, and a lobbying firm. All scientific organizations are urged to join the fund, Fund's legal team goes to world court to claim compensation for all future biospheric damage to be paid into the fund by those wreaking the damage and the governments allowing it. Many meetings follow, no doubt explaining the presence in this chapter of most of the novel's sex scenes. Authors seemingly familiar with and perhaps over fond of the bonobo literature. Strenuous attempts to maximize reproductive success in Davos, Santa Fe, Las Vegas, etc. Novel's style shifts to amalgam of legal thriller and Tolkien-esque high fantasy as scientists take power from corporate military industrial global elite. A Spinradian strategic opacity here obscures the actual mechanism that would allow this to work in the real world, said opacity created by deployment of complicated syntax, phrases low in semantic content, information cascade, especially active stage business, man runs through with hair on fire, explosions, car chases, and re-invocation of very big numbers. In this case, Science Mutual's potential assets if World Court returns positive judgment, after which subsequent chapter, with toll-free number as epigraph, emerges in newly utopian space, looking plausible to those still suspended in Coleridgean willed non-disbelief. Speed of narration accelerates. Science Mutual arranges winners in all elections everywhere. Hedge fund continues to grow. Scientific organizations form international supra-organization. Black helicopters proliferate. Entire population decides to follow new scientific guidelines indicating that reproductive fitness is maximal the closer behavior conforms to Paleolithic norms, this being the lifestyle that tripled brain size in only 1.2 million years. Widespread uptake of this behavioral set, augmented by appropriate technology, especially dentistry, reduces global resource demand by an order of magnitude despite demographic surge to UN predicted mid-range peak of 10 billion humans. A rationally balanced positive feedback loop into maximized universal fitness obtains. Novel ends with standard finale, singing, dancing, reproducing. All Terran organisms live optimally ever after. Please give your recommendation. Reader recommends acceptance for publication, but suggests that the apparent size of the text strategic opacity be reduced to 3 seconds of arc or less. Publisher should take steps to secure a domain name, sciencemutual.com. Also, more car chases. All right, I promised speculative fiction, and that was highly speculative. Prometheus Unbound at Last by Kim Stanley Robinson. All right, I'm going to plug in one more of his. It's called Before I Wake. Then he woke up and it was all a dream. In his dream, Abernathy stood on a steep rock ridge. A talus slope dropped from the ridge to a glacial basin containing a small lake. The lake was cobalt in the middle, aquamarine around the edges. Here and there in the rock expanse, patches of meadowgrass gleamed like the lawns of Marmot Estates. There were no trees. The cold air felt thin in his throat. Hold on, I'm holding. The wind is blowing. My chair is creaking. There were no trees. The cold air felt thin in his throat. He could see ranges many miles away, and though everything was perfectly still, there was also an immense sweep in things, as if a gust of wind had caught the very fabric of being. Okay, this is Norman speaking again. That's why I stopped, because I was taken by the fact that the wind started whipping. It really picked up out there outside my window, right as I was reading those sentences about the wind. Anyways, back to the story. "Wake up, damn you," a voice said. He was shoved in the back, and he tumbled down the rockfall, starting a small avalanche. He stood in a large white room. Glass boxes of various sizes were stacked everywhere, 4 and 5 to a pile, and in every box was a sleeping animal. Monkey, rat, dog, cat, pig, dolphin, turtle. "No," he said, backing up. "Please, no." A bearded man entered the room. "Come on, wake up," he said brusquely. "Time to get back at it, Fred. Our only hope is to work as hard as we can. You have to resist when you start slipping away." He seized Abernathy by the arms and sat him down on a box of squirrels. "Now listen," he cried. "We're asleep. We're dreaming." "Thank God," Abernathy said. "Not so fast. We're awake as well." "I don't believe you." "Yes, you do." He slapped Abernathy in the chest with a large roll of graph paper, and it spilled loose and unrolled over the floor. Black squiggles smeared the graphs. "It looks like a musical score," Abernathy said absently. The bearded man shouted, "Yes, yes, this is the symphony our brains play. Very apt. Violins yammering away. That's what used to be ours, Fred. That was consciousness." He yanked hard on his beard with both hands, looking anguish. Sudden drop to the basses, bowing and bowing. Blessed sleep, yes, yes. And in the night, the ghost instruments, horn and oboe and viola, spinning their little improvs over the ground bass. Longer and longer till the violins start blasting again. Yes, Fred, it's perfectly apt. "Thank you," Abernathy said, "but you don't have to yell. I'm right here." "Then wake up," the man said viciously. Can you? Trapped, aren't you? Playing the new song like all the rest of us. Look at it there, our REM sleep mixed indiscriminately with consciousness and deep sleep, turning us all into dreamwalkers, into waking nightmares." Looking into the depths of the man's beard, Abernathy saw that all his teeth were incisors. Abernathy edged toward the door, then broke for it and ran. The man leaped forward and tackled him, and they tumbled to the floor. Abernathy woke up. "Aha," the man said. It was Winston, administrator of the lab. "So now you believe me," he said sourly, rubbing an elbow. I suppose we should write that down on the walls. If we all start slipping away, we won't even remember what things used to be like. It'll be all over then." "Where are we?" Abernathy asked. "In the lab," Winston replied, voice filled with heavy patience. "We live here now, Fred, remember?" Abernathy looked around. The lab was large and well lit. Sheets of graph paper recording EEGs were scattered over the floor. Black countertops protruded from the walls, which were cluttered with machinery. In one corner were two rats in a cage. Abernathy shook his head violently. It was all coming back. He was awake now, but the dream had been true. He groaned, walked to the room's little window, saw the smoke rising from the city below. "Where's Jill?" Winston shrugged. They hurried through a door at the end of the lab into a small room containing cots and blankets. No one there. "She's probably gone back to the house again," Winston hissed with irritation and worry. "I'll check the grounds," he said. "You'd better go to the house. Be careful." Fred was already out the door. In many places, the streets were almost blocked by smashed cars, but little had changed since Abernathy's last venture home, and he made good time. The suburbs were choking in haze that smelled like incinerator smoke. A gas station attendant holding a pump handle stared in astonishment as he drove by, then waved. Abernathy didn't wave back. On one of these expeditions, he'd seen a knifing, and now he didn't like to look. He stopped the car at the curb before his house, the remains of his house. It was charred, almost to the ground. The blackened chimney was all that stood over chest height. He got out of his old Cortina and slowly crossed the lawn, which was marked by black footprints. In the distance, a dog barked insistently. Jill stood in the kitchen, humming to herself and moving black things from here to there. She looked up as Abernathy stopped in the side yard before her. Her eyes twitched from side to side. "You're home," she said cheerily. "How's your day?" "Jill, let's go out to dinner," Abernathy said. "But I'm already cooking." "I can see that." He stepped over what had been the kitchen wall and took her arm. "Don't worry about that. Let's go anyway." "My, my," said Jill, brushing his face with a sooty hand. "Aren't you romantic this evening?" He stretched his lips wide. "You bet. Come on." He pulled her carefully out of the house and across the yard and helped her into the Cortina. "Such chivalry," she remarked, eyes darting about in tandem. Abernathy got in and started the engine. "But Fred," his wife said, "what about Jeff and Fran?" Abernathy looked out the window. "They've got a babysitter," he said finally. Jill frowned, nodded, sat back in her seat. Her broad face was smudged. "Ah," she said, "I do so like to dine out." "Yes," Abernathy said and yawned. He felt drowsy. "Oh, no," he said. "No," he bit his lip, pinched the back of the hand on the wheel, yawned again. "No," he cried. Jill jerked against their door in surprise. He swerved to avoid hitting an Oriental woman sitting in the middle of the road. "I must get to the lab," he shouted. He pulled down the Cortina's sun visor, took a pen from his coat pocket, and scrawled, "To the lab." Jill was staring at him. "It wasn't my fault," she whispered. He drove them onto the freeway. All 30 lanes were clear, and he put his foot down on the accelerator. "To the lab," he sang. "To the lab! To the lab!" A flying police vehicle landed on the highway ahead of them, folded its wings, and sped off. Abernathy tried to follow it, but the freeway turned and narrowed. They were back on street level. He shouted with frustration, bit the flesh at the base of his thumb. Jill leaned back against her door, crying. Her eyes looked like small beings, a team trying to jerk its way free. "I couldn't help it," she said. "He loved me, you know, and I loved him." Abernathy drove on. Some streets were burning. He wanted to go west, needed to go west. The car was behaving oddly. They were on a tree-lined avenue, out where there were few houses. A giant Boeing 747 lay across the road. Oops, I skipped a page. Its wings slewed forward. A high tunnel had been cut through it so traffic could pass. A cop with a whistle and white gloves waved them through. On the dashboard, an emergency light blinked. "To the lab." Abernathy sobbed convulsively. "I don't know how." Jill, his sister, sat up straight. "Turn left," she said quietly. Abernathy threw the directional switch and their car rerouted itself onto the track that veered left. They came to other splits in the track, and each time Jill told him which way to go. The rearview mirror bloomed with smoke. Then he woke up. Winston was swabbing his arm with a wad of cotton, wiping off a droplet of blood. "Amphetamines and pain," Winston whispered. They were in the lab. About a dozen lab techs, postdocs, and grad students were in there at their countertops, working with great speed. "How's Jill?" Abernathy said. "Fine, fine. She's sleeping right now. Listen, Fred, I found a way to keep us awake for longer periods of time. Amphetamines and pain. Regular injections of benzedrine, plus a sharp burst of pain every hour or so, administered in whatever way you find most convenient. Metabolism stays too high for the mind to slip into the dreamwalking. I tried it and stayed fully awake and alert for 6 hours. Now we're all using the method." Abernathy watched the lab techs dash about. "I can tell." He could feel his heart's rapid, emphatic thumping. "Well, let's get to it," Winston said intently. "Let's make use of the time." Abernathy stood. Winston called a little meeting. Feeling the gazes fixed on him, Abernathy collected his thoughts. The mind consists of electrochemical action. Since we're all suffering the effects of this, it seems to me we can ignore the chemical and concentrate on the electrical. If the ambient fields have changed, anyone know how many Gauss the magnetic field is now, or what the cosmic ray count is? They stared at him. We can tune into the space station's monitor, he said, and do the rest here. So he worked, and they worked with him. Every hour, a grinning Winston came around with hypodermics in hand, singing, "Speed! Speed! Speed!" He convinced Abernathy to let droplets of hydrochloric acid fall on the inside of his forearm. It kept Abernathy awake better than it did the others. For a whole day, then, too, he worked without pause, eating crackers and drinking water as he worked, giving himself the injections when Winston wasn't there. After the first few hours, his assistants began slipping back into dreamwalking, despite the injections and acid splashings. Assignments he gave were never completed. One of his techs presented him with a successful experiment, the two rats grafted together at the leg. Vainly, Abernathy tried to pummel the man back to wakefulness. In the end, he did all the work himself. It took days. As his techs collapsed or wandered off, he shifted from counter to counter, squinting sand-filled eyes to read oscilloscope and computer screen. He had never felt so exhausted in his life. It was like taking tests in a subject he didn't understand, in which he was severely retarded. Still, he kept working. The EEG showed oscillation between wakefulness and REM sleep in a pattern he'd never seen. And there were correlations between the EEGs and fluctuations in the magnetic field. Some of the men's flickering eyes were open, and they sat on the floors talking to each other or to him. Once he had to calm Winston, who was on the floor weeping and saying, "We'll never stop dreaming, Fred. We'll never stop." Abernathy gave him an injection, but it didn't have any effect. He kept working. He sat at a crowded table at his high school reunion and found he could work anyway. He gave himself an injection whenever he remembered. He got very, very tired. Eventually, he felt he understood as much as he was going to. Everyone else was lying in the cot room with Jill or was slumped on the floors. Eyes and eyelids were twitching. We move through space filled with dust and gas and fields of force. Now all the constants have changed. The readouts from the space station show signs of a strong electromagnetic field we've apparently moved into. More dust, cosmic rays, gravitational flux. Perhaps it's a shockwave of a supernova, something nearby that we're just seeing now. Anyone looked up into the sky lately? Anyway, something. The altered field has thrown the electrical patterns of our brains into something like what we call the REM state. Our brains rebel and struggle towards consciousness as much as they can, but this field forces them back. So we oscillate, he laughed weakly, and crawled up onto one of the countertops to get some sleep. He woke and brushed the dust off his lab coat, which had served him as a blanket. The dirt road he had been sleeping on was empty. He walked. It was cloudy and nearly dark. He passed a small group of shacks, built in a tropical style with open walls and palm thatch roofs. They were empty. Dark light filled the sky. Then he was at the sea's edge. Before him extended a low promontory composed of thousands of wooden chairs all crushed and piled together. At the point of the promontory, there was a human figure seated in a big chair that still had seat and back and one arm. Abernathy stepped out carefully onto slats and lathed cylinders of wood from a chair arm to the plywood bottom of a chair seat. Around him, the gray ocean was strangely calm. Glassy swells rose and fell over the slick wood at waterline without a sound. Insubstantial clouds of fog, the lowest parts of a solid cloud cover, floated slowly on shore. The air was salty and wet. Abernathy shivered, stepped down to the next fragment of weathered gray wood. The seated man turned to look at him. It was Winston. "Fred!" he called loud in the silence of the dawn. Abernathy approached him, picked up a chair back, and placed it carefully, sat. "How are you?" Winston said. Abernathy nodded. "Okay." Down close to the water, he could hear the small slaps and sucking of the seas rise and fall. The swells looked a bit larger, and he could see thin, smoky mist rising from them as they approached the shore. "Winston," he croaked and cleared his throat, "what's happened?" "We're dreaming." "But what does that mean?" Winston laughed wildly. "Emergent stage one sleep, transitional sleep, rapid sleep, rhombencephalic sleep, pontine sleep, activated sleep, paradoxical sleep." He grinned ironically. "No one knows what it is." "But all those studies." "Yeah, all those studies. And how I used to believe in them. How I used to work for them. All those sorry guesses ranging from the ridiculous to the absurd. We dream to organize experience into memory, to stimulate the senses in the dark, to prepare for the future, to give our depth perception exercise, for God's sake. I mean, we don't know, do we, Fred? We don't know what dreaming is. We don't know what sleep is. You only have to think about it a bit to realize we didn't know what consciousness itself was, what it meant to be awake. Did we ever really know? We lived, we slept, we dreamed, and all three equal mysteries. Now that we're doing all three at once, is the mystery any deeper?" Abernathy picked at the grain in the wood of a chair leg. "Well, a lot of the time I feel normal," he said. "It's just that strange things keep happening. Your EEGs display an unusual pattern," Winston said, mimicking a scientific tone. "More alpha and beta waves than the rest of us, as if you're struggling hard to wake up."
"Yes, that's what it feels like." They sat in silence for a time, watching swells lap at the wet chairs. The tide was falling. Offshore, near the limit of visibility, Abernathy saw a large cabin cruiser drifting in the current.
"So, tell me what you've found," Winston said.
Abernathy described the data transmitted from the space station, then his own experiments. Winston nodded.
"So, we're stuck here. For good."
"Well, unless we pass through this field, or I've gotten an idea for a device you could wear around your head that might restore the old field."
"A solution seen in a dream?"
"Well, yes," Winston laughed.
"I used to believe in our rationality, Fred. Dreams is some sort of electrochemical manifestation of the nervous system, random activity. How reasonable it all sounded. Give the depth perception exercise. God, how small-minded it all was. Why shouldn't we have believed that dreams were great travels to the future, to other universes, to a world more real than our own? They felt that way sometimes, in that last second before waking, as if we lived in a world so charged with meaning that it might burst. And now here we are. We're here, Fred. This is the moment and our only moment. No matter how we name it, we're here. From idea to symbol, perhaps, people will adapt. That's one of our talents."
"I don't like it," Abernathy said. "I never liked my dreams." Winston merely laughed at him.
"They say consciousness itself was a leap like this one. People were ambling around like dogs, and then one day, maybe because the earth moved through the shock wave of some distant explosion, sure, one day, one of them straightened up and looked around surprised and said, 'I am.'"
"That would be a surprise," Abernathy said.
"And this time, everyone woke up one morning still dreaming and looked around and said, 'Am I?'" Winston laughed. Yes, we're stuck here, but I can adapt, he pointed. Look, that boat out there is sinking. They watched several people aboard the craft struggle to get a rubber raft over the side. After many dunkings, they got it in the water and everyone inside it. Then they rowed away, offshore, into the mist. I'm afraid, Abernathy said. Then he woke up. He was back in the lab. It was in worse shape than ever. A couple of countertops had been swept clean to make room for chessboards. Several techs were playing, blindfolded, arguing over which board was which. He went to Winston's offices to get more Benzedrine. There was no more. He grabbed one of his postdocs and said, How long have I been asleep? The man's eyes twitched, and he sang his reply. 16 men on a dead man's chest. Yo, ho, ho, and a bottle of rum. Abernathy went to the cot room. Jill was there, naked except for light blue underwear, smoking a cigarette. One of the grad students was brushing her nipples with a feather. Oh, hi, Fred, she said, looking him straight in the eye. Where have you been? Talking to Winston, he said with difficulty. Have you seen him? Yeah, I don't know when, though. He started to work alone again. No one wanted to help. He cleared a small room off the main lab and dragged in the equipment he needed. He locked three large boxes of crackers in a cabinet and tried to lock himself in his room whenever he felt drowsy. Once he spent 6 weeks in China. Then he woke up. Sometimes he woke out in his old Cortina, hugging the steering wheel like his only friend. All his friends were lost. Each time he went back and started working again. He could stay awake for hours at a time. He got lots done. The magnets were working well. He was getting the fields he wanted. The device for placing the field around the head, an odd-looking wire helmet, was practical. He was tired. It hurt to blink. Every time he felt drowsy, he applied more acid to his arm. It was covered with burns, but none of them hurt anymore. When he woke, he felt as if he hadn't slept for days. Twice his grad students helped out, and he was grateful for that. Winston came by occasionally, but only laughed at him. He was too tired. Everything he did was clumsy. He got on the lab phone once and tried to call his parents. All the lines were busy. The radio was filled with static, except for a station that played nothing but episodes of The Lone Ranger. He went back to work. He ate crackers and worked. He worked, and he worked. Late one afternoon, he went out onto the lab's cafeteria terrace to take a break. The sun was low and a chill breeze blew. He could see the air filled with amber light, and he breathed it in violently. Below him, the city smoked and the wind blew, and he knew that he was alive, that he was aware he was alive, and that something important was pushing into the world, suffusing things. Jill walked onto the terrace, still wearing nothing but the blue underwear. She stepped on the balls of her feet, smiled oddly. Abernathy could see goose pimples sweep across her skin like cat's paws over water, and the power of her present, distant, female, mysterious, filled him with fear. They stood several feet apart and looked down at the city where their house had been. The area was burning. Jill gestured at it. It's too bad we only had the courage to live our lives fully in dreams. I thought we were doing okay, Abernathy said. I thought we engaged it the best we could every waking moment. She stared at him again with a knowing smile. You did think that, didn't you? Yes, he said fiercely. I did. He went inside to work it off. Then he woke up. He was in the mountains and the high cirque again. He was higher now and could see two more lakes, tiny granite pools, above the cobalt and aquamarine one. He was climbing shattered granite, getting near the pass. Lichen mottled the rocks. The wind dried the sweat on his face, cooled him. It was quiet and still, so quiet. "Wake up!" It was Winston. Abernathy was in his little room. High ranges in the distance, the dusty green of forest below, wedged in a corner. He got up, went to the crackers cabinet, pumped himself full of the Benzedrine he had found in some syringes on the floor, snow and lichen. He went into the main lab and broke the fire alarm. That got everyone's attention. It took him a couple of minutes to stop the alarm. When he did, his ears were ringing. "The device is ready to try," he said to the group. There were about 20 of them. Some were as neat as if they were off to church. Others were tattered and dirty. Jill stood to one side. Winston crashed to the front of the group. "What's ready?" he shouted. "The device to stop us dreaming," Abernathy said weakly. "It's ready to try," Winston said slowly. "Well, let's try it then, okay, Fred?" Abernathy carried helmets and equipment out of his room and into the lab. He arranged the transmitters and powered the magnets and the field generators. When it was all ready, he stood up and wiped his brow. "Is this it?" Winston asked. Abernathy nodded. Winston picked up one of the wire helmets. "Well, I don't like it," he said, and struck the helmet against the wall. Abernathy's mouth dropped open. One of the techs gave a shove to his electromagnets, and in a sudden fury, Abernathy picked up a bat of wood and hit the man. Some of his assistants leaped to his aid. The rest pressed in and pulled at his equipment, tearing it down. A tremendous fight erupted. Abernathy swung his slab of wood with abandon, feeling great satisfaction each time it struck. There was blood in the air. His machines were being destroyed. Jill picked up one of the helmets and threw it at him, screaming, "It's your fault! It's your fault!" He knocked down a man near his magnets and had swung the slab back to kill him when suddenly he saw a bright glint in Winston's hand. It was a surgical knife, and with a swing like a sidearm pitcher's, Winston slammed the knife into Abernathy's diaphragm, burying it. Abernathy staggered back, tried to draw in a breath, and found that he could. He was all right. He hadn't been stabbed. He turned and ran. He dashed onto the terrace, closely pursued by Winston and Jill and the others, who tripped and fell even as he did. The patio was much higher than it used to be, far above the city, which burned and smoked. There was a long, wide stairway descending into the heart of the city. Abernathy could hear screams. It was night and windy. He couldn't see any stars. He was at the edge of the terrace. He turned and the group was right behind him, faces twisted with fury. "No!" he cried, and then they rushed him, and he swung the wood slab and swung it and swung it and turned to run down the stairs, and then, without knowing how he had done it, he tripped and fell head over heels down the rocky staircase, falling, falling, falling. And then he woke up. He was falling. All right, that's my speculative chair creaking. Now that story's over. By the inimitable Kim Stanley Robinson. Before I Wake, it was entitled. Okay, I think we got about 15 minutes left. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Good Night Norman, the radio station WGXC 90.7 FM. Headquartered on Main Street in Catskill and at the Wave Farm in Acre, here in the beautiful Hudson Valley, where I'm broadcasting from the top floor of my walk-up.
downtown Hudson. WGXC is a community radio station. I think there's a big fundraiser coming up at the Avalon Lounge. You should check out the website and read all about it. But I'm going to see if I can find information to read about it. All right, I don't find anything. Wait. Here we go. No, we're not. Did you know that WGXC, actually not WGXC, but a parent organization, Wave Farm, distributes grants, the Media Arts Assistance Fund, for organizations and for individual artists to complete and present new works in sound and moving image, including emerging technologies. But I'm pretty sure these deadlines just passed. Oh, no, they're due March 1st. So get it in there. It's a NISCA, New York State Council on the Arts program, if you're into that kind of thing, writing grants and such. I've sort of given up on that myself. But there is a fundraiser at the Avalon Lounge on the 22nd of February. That's this coming Saturday at 8 p.m., 29 Church Street in Catskill, theavalonlounge.com. Come on out. It's your favorite community radio station. And all kinds of stuff is going to be happening there. But all I'm getting is ellipses and no, hold on. I want to tell you about this because I don't feel like I do enough fundraising. Plus, the Avalon Lounge is a cool place. So here it all is. I'm going to read this. Dominic and the Family Band. It's $15 at the door, $12 in advance, which is not bad for a fundraiser. Dromedary Records is the presenter of this fundraiser. And it features Dominic and the Family Band, a cosmic blend of breezy folk rock, alt country, and odd meter grooves, drawing from the Birds to Cass McCombs. Was that Mama Cass? I don't know. There's also Hush Woods from Kingston, New York. More indie rock. And a couple of post-punk noise bands. $500. And the entire earth. So come on down. $15 to support your community radio station. And go to the website, wgxc.org, and you could probably participate in some way other than that. Or drop in at the office on Main Street in Catskill, New York. All right, I did my bit there. I hope that the boss was listening. But really, seriously, I think it's a pretty good radio station. You should listen, and you should go, just if you just go to WGXC.org or to Wave Farm, you can find a little thing, a little clicker that says donate. You can find the usual things, like you know how to navigate a web page at this point. You know, you can donate, make donations, one-time donation, you can use a check, you can use Venmo, you can use PayPal, you can donate stocks and securities or cryptocurrency, you can donate whatever you want, you can donate your time, you can do a one-time or a monthly donation, all those options are there, you just get that little rollover script going, so the little flying, pointing finger of fate is before your eyes and click and whir. This is a fairy tale called The Sleeping Queen. It's transcribed and re-edited by Italo Calvino and then translated by George Martin. I don't think he might be related to he might be the guy who did Lord of the Rings. I mean, the Game of the Thrones. I mean, the Lord of the Thrones. I mean, the Game of the Rings. This is from Calvino's compilation called The Sleeping Queen, called Italian Folktales. Sorry, the tale is called Sleeping Queen, where he went around Italy and got all these old people to tell him crazy folktales. And then he wrote them down. Can you hear that paper rustling? The Sleeping Queen. And it's from the region of Montali Pistoiese. Spain was once ruled by the good and just King Maximilian. He had three sons, William, John, and little Andrew, the youngest and his father's favorite. Following an illness, the king lost his eyesight. Though all the doctors in the kingdom were summoned, none knew of any remedy. One of the oldest doctors suggested, since medical knowledge is limited in this case, send for a soothsayer. So soothsayers from everywhere were called in. They pored over their books, but proved no wiser than the doctors in the end. With the soothsayers, a wizard had slipped in, a stranger to everyone. After the others had all had their say, the wizard came forward and spoke. I am familiar with cases of blindness like yours, King Maximilian. The cure is nowhere to be found but in the Sleeping Queen city. It is the water in her well. People's amazement at those words had not yet died down before the wizard vanished and was never heard of again. The king was eager to find out who he was, but no one had ever laid eyes on the man before. One of the soothsayers thought he might be a wizard from the vicinity of Armenia, come to Spain by means of magic. The king asked, could the Sleeping Queen city also be thereabouts? An old courtier replied, we won't know where it is until we look for it. If I was younger, I'd go in search of it myself without delay. William, the eldest son, stepped forward. If anyone is to set out in search of the city, I'm the one to go. It is only fitting that the firstborn put his father's health above all other concerns. Dear son, replied the king, you have my blessing. Take money and horses and everything else you need. I'll be expecting you back victorious in 3 months. William went to the king's port and boarded a vessel sailing for the Isle of Buda, where it was to anchor for 3 hours before continuing on to Armenia. At Buda, he went ashore to see the island. As he strolled about, he met a charming lady and became so engrossed in talking to her that the 3 hours went by before he knew it. At the appointed time, the ship unfurled its sails and departed without William. He was sorry at first, but the lady's company made him soon forget all about his father's illness and the original purpose of his voyage. When the 3 months were up, with still no sign of William, the king began fearing the boy was dead, and to the pain of going blind was added that of losing a son. To console him, John, the middle boy, volunteered to go in search of his brother as well as the water. The king consented, although fearful that something would happen to this son, too. On the boat, John soon came in sight of the Isle of Buda. This time the ship was to anchor there for a day. John went ashore to look around the island. He strolled into a park of myrtles, cypresses, and laurels, which shaded lagoons of limpid water stocked with fish of every color of the rainbow. From there he proceeded through the town's beautiful avenues and streets to a square where a white marble fountain stood in its center. Encircling the square were monuments and buildings, and in their midst rose a majestic palace with gold and silver columns and crystal walls that sparkled in the sunlight. John spied his brother moving about on the other side of those crystal walls. "Willie," he cried, "what are you doing here? Why did you not come home? We thought you was dead." And they embraced. William told how, once he'd set foot on the island, he'd been unable to tear himself away, and how he'd been received by the beautiful lady who owned everything in sight. "This lady is Lugistula," he added, "and she has a very lovely little sister named Isabel. If you like her, she's yours." In short, 12 hours went by, and the ship sailed without John. After a brief spell of remorse, he too forgot all about his father in the miraculous water and became a guest like his brother in the Crystal Palace. When the 3 months were up, with no sign of the second son, King Maximilian was alarmed, and with the entire court feared the worst. Then little Andrew boldly declared he'd go in search of his brothers and the Sleeping Queen's magic water. "So you intend to leave me too?" said the king. "Blind and crushed as I am, I must give up my last son as well." But Andrew revived his hope of seeing the three boys back safe and sound, in addition to obtaining the wonderful water. So his father consented at last to his departure. The ship dropped anchor at the Isle of Budao, where it would remain for 2 days. "You may disembark," the captain told Andrew, "but be back on time if you don't want to be left behind like two other young men who went ashore and have not been heard of since." Andrew realized he was talking of his brothers, who must be somewhere on the island. So he began looking around and found them in the Crystal Palace. They embraced, and the brothers told Andrew about the spell that kept them on Budao. "We're in a real paradise here," they told him. "We each have a beautiful lady, the mistress of the island's mind, as sisters John's. If you'll join us, I believe our ladies still have a cousin." But Andrew cut them off. "You've obviously lost your minds if you don't remember your duty to father. I intend to find the Sleeping Queen's magic water, and nothing can turn me from that resolution, neither riches nor amusements nor beautiful ladies." At those words, the brothers became silent and walked away in a huff. Andrew returned at once to the ship. The sails were unfurled, and favorable winds carried the vessel straight to Armenia. As soon as he was on Armenian soil, Andrew asked everyone he met where the Sleeping Queen's city was, but apparently no one had ever heard of it. After weeks of vain search, he was directed to an old man living on a mountaintop. "He's an old, old man, as old as the world itself, by the name of Farfanello. If he doesn't know where the city is, nobody knows," he was told. Andrew climbed the mountain. He found the bearded, decrepit old man in his hut and told him what he was seeking. "Dear youth," said Farfanello, "I have indeed heard of this place, but it's quite far away. First you have to cross an ocean, and that'll take almost a month, to say nothing of the perils of sailing the waters. But even if you do get across them safe and sound, still greater dangers lie in store for you on the Sleeping Queen's Isle, the very name of which suggests misfortune, since they call it the Isle of Tears." Glad to have definite information at last, Andrew embarked at the port of Brindisi. The ocean crossing was hazardous because huge polar bears capable of wrecking even big ships swam in the waters. But Andrew, a courageous hunter, was not afraid, and the vessel steered clear of the polar bear's claws and arrived at the Isle of Tears. The port looked abandoned, and not a sound was to be heard. Andrew disembarked and saw a sentinel holding a gun, but the man was completely motionless. Even though Andrew asked him for direction, he continued to stand as still and silent as a statue. Next, Andrew approached the porters about his baggage, but they didn't move a muscle. Some held heavy trunks on their backs with 1 foot forward and raised. Andrew entered the city. On one side of the street, he saw a cobbler, still and silent, halted in the midst of drawing thread through a shoe. On the other side, a coffee house keeper held a pot in position to pour a lady a cup of coffee, but both he and she were mute and motionless. Streets, windows, and shops were full of people, but they all looked like figures of wax in the strangest of postures. Even the horses, dogs, cats, and other creatures were standing dead still in their tracks. Moving through this thick silence, Andrew came to a splendid palace adorned with statues and tablets commemorating the island's past kings. On the facade was a frieze full of figures with an inscription in radiant letters of gold: "To Her Majesty, the Queen of Luminous Souls, who reigns over this Isle of Paramus." Well, folks, I'm out of time. So you're not going to see what, you're not going to hear what happens to the Sleeping Queen or the youngest, unless I remember to read this next time, which will be the 2nd of March. You've been listening to Good Night.